Hey everyone, welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. I am really excited about this week's episode. It's going to be a good one. I am sitting down with Phil Ferguson of Polaris Financial, and I know it's got that word financial in it, and if you're worried that it may be a snooze, trust me, it is not. It is really interesting to learn about science-based and evidence-based investing. He has helped me a lot in my life. I think he could help you in yours. Lots of fun stuff coming up. But first, I want to thank all of you who have sent me happy birthday wishes over the interwebs. It means a lot to me. My birthday is today, Monday, October 19th, the day that this episode is airing. I'm the big 3-2. And you guys have been so sweet to help me celebrate. I got to spend the weekend with the people that I love. I had a really wonderful time after a pretty trying week of work and travel. But I got to spend some time in New York earlier this week to receive a wonderful journalism award from the Knight Foundation and CUNY J School and Neil deGrasse Tyson. So that was a whole lot of fun. And I do have one really big announcement that I want you guys to keep your eye on. It's the newest thing that I'm working on in my, you know, my day job, which is the TV stuff that I do. I have an amazing opportunity to co-host Brain Surgery Live with Mental Floss, which is airing on National Geographic on Sunday, October 25th at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 Central. So that would be, what, 6 Pacific. It is a two-hour live special where Bryant Gumbel will be hosting, which is so freaking cool. And I will be co-hosting along with Dr. Raul Jandial, who is a neurosurgeon. And we will be kind of giving the play-by-play and the color commentary of a live awake brain surgery for Parkinson's and dyskinesia. It is a deep brain stimulation surgery. Very cool. Going to be a lot of fun. I am really looking forward to it. I'm going to be traveling later in the week for all of the prep around it. And yeah, I hope you guys will tune in. At least set your DVRs, but really you should tune in. It's live. It's the first time there's ever going to be a live brain surgery on TV. Pretty cool. All right, guys, I have a couple of people to thank this week. I want to thank once again Mark Mirsky for his generous support of the podcast through the PayPal portal. If you're interested in supporting Talk Nerdy, you can go to carasantamaria.com and you'll see all of the different outlets to do it there. You can do it via PayPal on a once a month or a one-time basis only, or you can click through to Patreon. The direct link there would be patreon.com/talknerdy. And there at Patreon, which is a per episode support system, I want to thank Phil T-Bear, Timothy Glover, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, Jeffrey Sewell, and literally the hundreds of others who help support the show, you know, with a dollar here, $5 there. It really, really helps keep it going, and it helps it remain free for all of you to download week after week. All right, I think that's all the news this week. I'm sure I'm forgetting something, but I apologize. I'll try and remember for next week. So I think without further ado, let's jump right into the show. This week, I sit down with Phil Ferguson of Polaris Financial Planning. He is a fiduciary. You'll learn what that means later in the show. And he is really interested in science-based or evidence-based financial planning. So what we're talking about here is long-term retirement planning and trying to understand a lot of the jargon around mutual funds and index funds and all of the fees. And we do some really fun calculations in the show that I think you guys will really enjoy. All right, without any further ado, here he is, Phil Ferguson. Well, Phil, thank you so much for joining me this week on Talk Nerdy.
It is my pleasure.
I'm so excited. What's really funny is that we just recorded the Phil Ferguson show like 2 days ago.
We did indeed. Now, I was hoping on your show I could practice my Italian.
Yeah, we could do some Italian. I won't be able to understand you, but some of my listeners will. I know I have some listeners from Italy.
I've got something I've prepped. You ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
Permette che mi presenti. Mi chiamo Phil Ferguson.
Let me present myself. My name is Phil Ferguson.
Yeah, you're good. It's like you know how to speak Italian or something.
It sounded, well, Italian's not that different from Spanish. And even though I hardly speak Spanish, I speak a little bit of Spanish.
It helps. Matter of fact, I've heard people over talking in Spanish and I'm thinking to myself, wow, I can understand some of what they're saying because I've learned Italian.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. My mom is a Spanish speaker, native Spanish speaker. She's from Puerto Rico, and she also teaches Spanish. Well, she just retired this past year, but I think she's still teaching because she's a crazy person. And she can speak Spanish, Italian, and Portuguese because they're all very similar. And I know that sometimes it gets confusing because you mix up which language is which, but she studied linguistics in school, and all three of those are built on obviously the same kind of Latin base.
That is fantastic. Now, my daughter spent an entire year in Brazil, so she knows Brazilian Portuguese. She's fluent.
Oh, that's crazy.
And so, go ahead.
How different is it, Brazilian Portuguese, from Portugal Portuguese?
Oh, gosh, that, I don't know. It's probably very similar.
Yeah, probably just a different dialect or something.
Yeah, different dialect, little bits of slang, maybe word sequences sometimes change. Like in Italian, you can put the personal pronoun before or after the verb. And my daughter was explaining to me in Brazilian Portuguese, you do it one way. In Portuguese, you do it the other way. And I'm like, but you would understand each other. And they're like, yeah. So,
oh, gotcha. But yeah. So it just sounds a little different.
Yeah. And her and I will always compare words like, fantastico is Italian and fantastico is also Portuguese. And I'm sure it's probably the same word in Spanish.
It is. Yeah. Fantastico.
And they sound very similar. And then you have, like in Spanish, to run, the verb to run is probably, what is it, correr, correre?
Correr. Oh, I have no idea. I know andar is to walk. I don't know how to say to andar. Run. I'm looking at it. Andar, to run.
Well, in Italian, to go is andare.
Oh, there you go. That makes sense. To run in Spanish is correr. Yeah.
Yeah, see, correr, and in Italian is correre.
Yeah, so, it's really similar.
Yeah.
Am I right saying andar is to walk? I thought so, but you also say andar in bicicleta, which is like to ride a bike, which is kind of weird.
Well, it's funny, in Italian, andare in bicicleta is it's to go on a bike.
Yeah, no, it is. It's like to travel, to walk. It's like to travel by foot, which is to walk. So, but also to take a bike, yeah.
In Italian, they would say andare in piede. It's go in foot, to walk in foot.
Oh, there you go. And then I guess in Spanish, it's just shortened to andar. All right. So people at this point probably think that I have you on the show as
a
linguist.
It's a special linguist show.
Yeah. But I actually have you on the show because, Phil Ferguson, you are a financial planner, which sounds like an odd choice for a guest for Talk Nerdy. But kind of your interesting angle as a financial planner is that you are the evidence-based financial planner.
That's
a good way to put it?
That is. As a matter of fact, a couple of years ago, I was explaining to someone what I do, and they coined the phrase, and I don't even remember who said it, but I stole it. It's science-based investing.
I love it. So I met you actually at a convention. I don't know if it was a skeptic convention or an atheist convention, but a lot of the same people cross over in those circles. Yeah. And I attend them from time to time, different ones, depending on if I've been invited to speak or if I have something going on there. And I can't remember if when we met, I was tabling. I think I was probably at a conference to speak.
I think it was a PastaCon last year.
There you go. So I probably was
Nerdy. You were hawking your wares.
I was hawking my wares, which I'm so bad at. There were actually people trying to help me because I would just sit there on my laptop and people would be like, you need to like sell stuff. And I was like, if they want it, they'll buy it.
Yeah. Well, I used to years ago when people would come up, because to have a financial planning table at an atheist or skeptic convention, can I swear on your show?
Yeah, you can swear.
Often people would come up and you'd be like, so what the fuck?
Yeah.
I'm here to hear about atheism or skepticism or Bigfoot or whatever. And I walk out here and here's this douchebag, talking about investing. How does that even make any fucking sense?
Mm-hmm.
And I would just go, oh, well, yeah, sure. Okay. Here, take a card. And then I'd dream and fantasize that they would call me by taking a card or pamphlet. And I learned that about 1 out of 50 people that actually made the effort to take a card would ever call me.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So now what I'll do is I'll strike up a conversation and talk to somebody and see if the conversation's going well. And I will ask them for their phone number and their email. And if they go, oh, no, I'm not interested in that. And I go, that's cool. Thanks for stopping by. Because now you're blocking my table.
And I actually became very interested because I think it was a bit serendipitous. At the time, I was sort of, I mean, I had money in investments, but it was like all over the place. I didn't have a plan. I had an old 401k or a 401k, as I like to call it, that I hadn't rolled over. I had an IRA that I didn't know if I could contribute to anymore. And I was, I think it might have been around, it probably wasn't around tax time, but I was probably starting to think about tax time because I had recently switched over from being a full-time employee of a news organization to being a full-time freelancer, which is a massive change in the way that I both pay my taxes and in the way that I invest.
Right.
And I'm, you know, in my early 30s. I think this was probably a couple of years ago when we first met, or maybe a year ago or so. So I was like coming on to my 30s, and I was like, I need to be not investing. Like, you know, I should probably be thinking about my future a little bit. I'm still young, but I'm not as much of a spring chicken as I was. So it was pretty serendipitous that, you know, I came across your table and we started talking, and then you started to kind of tell me about your philosophy when it comes to investment planning. Also, I think I had recently seen that amazing episode of Frontline, which is an old episode, but I recommend that everybody watch it.
I know what you're talking about. The one about 401ks and the fees and stuff?
Yes, it's about 401ks and fees and about index funds. But the title of it isn't that. It's something about like our retirement problem. Like, it really starts as a kind of, I don't know, an investigation into the fact that most people who are retiring today and in the future don't have pensions, and that, yeah, there are problems with their 401ks. And then it really goes into taking your own, sorry, I'm so sick, so I can't think today, but I'm really glad we're podcasting, taking it into your own hands. And then of course it goes into some different strategies, and they talk to a bunch of like hedge fund managers and different mutual fund managers, and also kind of skewer some people who take advantage of individuals. Well, and that's where I learned the term fiduciary.
I just used the Google, and I just put in the word frontline, all one word, and 401k, mm-hmm. and it comes up, The Retirement Gamble.
There you go. That's what it's called, The Retirement Gamble. So yeah, everybody should watch it. It's very well done.
It's not even that long, and it really gives you a lot of valuable information. And not only do I do science-based investing, which means I use a lot of long-term data, there's certain things that work and certain things that don't work. And one of the things that does not work is market timing, jumping in and out of the market. Some people do it and make a lot of money, but they are not the norm. Most people end up losing money, if not just in the investing, but once they consider the cost to do market timing and or the fees and taxes involved in doing such an activity.
So when you say market timing, you're talking about what we think of traditionally as like, quote, playing the stock market.
Yeah, playing the stock market. One of the phrases I love to tell people is that, and I'm sure this applies to you, Kara, have you ever met someone who is always trying to strike it rich?
Yes.
Did you notice they're always trying?
Yes.
So it can happen. Another thing that I'll say is that it's kind of like I'm the tortoise versus the hare. So if someone calls me and they say, how do I get rich quick? I say, well, you aren't going to be a client.
Yeah.
And they go like, what? And I go, that's not how it works. And if you think it does, all that's going to happen is at some point you're going to be an upset client, and you're going to harsh my mellow, and I don't want that, so go away.
Yeah, no, and it's the truth is, it is a little bit stressful when you have money invested, and you're the kind of person that is like constantly checking your bank accounts. And I definitely, my recommendation is that you just don't look. You just don't look at your totals all the time. You look at them, you know, a few times a year to make sure nobody's hacked your account or whatever. But for the most part, you know, do what you need to do around tax time, make your investments throughout the year based on the plan that you've worked out with your financial planner, but you don't have to look day to day to day to see how the market is changing and to see how your investments are doing, because the truth of the matter is we're talking about trends. This is like climate versus weather here.
Oh, I love that analogy.
Yeah, like when you want to talk about what are you going to retire on, it is not contingent on where your investments are tomorrow. It's contingent on how the summation of your investments are doing over many, many years, which is why it's also good to start early.
It really helps. And what I tell people is that I teach people how to money.
I like that. Money is a verb, just like science. I dig it.
That's right. And it's just like my kids who are now 19 and 20 are learning how to adult.
Yeah.
So there's things that you need to know. There's things that you need to understand. And the first part of learning how to money is you must be able to save money. And if you can't save money, you have no money to invest. Nothing else really matters. The second thing, of course, is the investing. And you want to learn that and do that as well as possible. And the third one is what you started with, is time. And the more time you have, the easier it is. And it really pains me when I have someone who's a couple years from retirement and they show up at my door or call me and say, I've got $100,000. I want to retire in 2 years and I want to take out $50,000 a year. How long will my money last?
And you're like, 2 years.
And I'm like, yeah, that's real easy. 2 years. Yeah. After that, you're moving into a single wide.
Yeah, that's rough.
So it can be a challenge. And of course, in that situation, you know, you could not retire, or you could get a part-time job, or you find a way to cut your budget way, way down.
Mm-hmm. And that's sad too, because I think a lot of us, there's this psychological phenomenon, and I'm not sure if it has a name, it probably does, but I remember learning about it way back when I was getting my psych degree as an undergrad, where the more you become comfortable with a lifestyle, the harder it is to go back to a previous lifestyle.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the things that I tell people all the time. And here's a book recommendation that goes with it. The book you want to read if you're starting to invest, or you have not started to invest and you're not quite sure why you need to start. The book is called The Richest Man in Babylon.
Okay, sounds biblical.
Yeah, allegedly these stories come from ancient Babylon 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 years ago when they were pressed on clay tablets that turned into stone. I don't know if that's actually true or not, but the stories are written as if they're from ancient Babylon, and the nice thing is it's fun to read. Cool. I actually had the Audible audiobook version, but it's fun to read, it's lighthearted, it's not that long. And it looks at things from a couple different angles, but the basic premise is you want to save at least 10%, and then you want to invest it wisely, and it gives you fun little lighthearted examples and really makes the point.
So 10%, I was going to ask you about that, because this is something that you hear a lot kind of thrown around. It's something, you know, I was raised in the Mormon church, and that was a big part of the Mormon church was tithing, and tithing was always 10%. Granted, you weren't saving it, you were giving it to the church. But this idea of 10% of your income being put away seems to be sort of a golden number. Is that the number that you also recommend? And also, where does it come from?
Well, you must be psychic, because I was just thinking about this. You're right. In the industry, often people will say 10%.
Mm-hmm.
I will say 10% is your suck-ass minimum number.
Gotcha.
So,
and that's 10% gross or 10% net? Because that's a really different number.
I guess gross is what I would go with. But if you can only do net, you know, so be it. But
then that's really your suck-ass minimum.
Yeah. And what you want to shoot for every year is 20. And a lot of people, when I explain to you exactly, that's the response of like, Phil, I can't save 10%. How am I going to save 20%? And I go, well, that's up to you. When do you want to retire?
Yeah.
So one way to think about it, if you make, I don't know, let's just say $50,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take that gross number, if you save 10%, $5,000, and you invest that amount in the stock market, and if you make 10% per year, in 30 years, you will be able to have income from that portfolio that is almost equivalent to your net now, $50,000 instead of $45,000, that you would have by not working.
I see. So if the stock market continues to go the way that it has trended for like hundreds of years.
That's correct.
Which is around between what, like 9 and 12%?
I would say 9 and 11, but yeah, you're in the right ballpark. Matter of fact, and this is one of the things of science-based medicine. So people, I'll give them, when I can, information they can go double check what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to Wikipedia and you Google S&P 500, you can see for the last 45 years, the S&P 500, which is not the total stock market, but over long periods of time, it really, really closely simulates it. The return is 10.47%.
There you go. So whether there were crashes, whether there were good years, on average, 10.47% every year for like ever.
And if you look back in data, now one of the things is some of this data is hard to get, but if you get one of my favorite books, actually what I call my personal Bible, mm-hmm. is Common Sense on Mutual Funds by John C. Bogle. He is the founder of the Vanguard Mutual Fund Company. Mm-hmm. And he has that data that's in Wikipedia that goes back over 100 years. And then there's an additional sets of data that go back 200 years. But yes, those are more sketchy. So keep that in mind. But it all shows over long periods of time, 20 years plus, the stock market makes 10% plus or minus 1% over 20-year time periods. And as an example, if you want some more specifics, one of the things that people often forget about and why I love your idea of looking at the market only from time to time, I tell people once a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like when it's tax time, like when you're getting ready to make your investments for the year or whatever.
Right.
Go ahead and look.
And the funny thing is that like any tool, you have to use it correctly. So if you are getting in and out, or if you are, and I've got all my air quotes up, podcast listeners, if you are playing the market, you are mm-hmm. doing it wrong. So in the last 45 years of data, again, you can go double check this in that Wikipedia page I gave. Do you know what the single best year in the last 45 years, how much the market went up?
Well, if it's averaging around 10 point some odd percent, the single best year I would assume would be like 40%.
Oh, you're good. It's about 38.
Wow, that's a good year.
That is, you know, if you have 100,000 at the beginning of the year and you have almost 140,000 at the end of the year, mm-hmm. that's really nice. Now, what's the worst drop in 1 year? In the last 45 years.
Probably about the same, right? About 38, maybe when the crash hit a few years ago with Lehman Brothers.
In 2008, uh-huh. it went down 37%.
Yeah, so the exact same. By the way, killer, this is upsetting killer, thinking about losing all that money.
it is very upsetting. Now, one of the uh-huh. things that happens is that is what you are looking at as far as risk in any given year. And when people make predictions, and you have a skeptical audience.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
When investment advisors or people on TV, like, you know, you look at MSNBC and they have someone, and they did this recently. I watched the show and they had someone on explaining why the market meltdown in China is going to destroy the U.S. market.
Yeah, just destroy it.
Destroy. I mean, we're going to lose 40, 50% overnight. They had the other person saying that this is going to be a great opportunity because of X, Y, and Z, and it's going to be one of the best years ever for the stock market. Well, they're both pulling it out of their ass. The problem is that the person that gets on and says, I have no idea what China is going to do to our market, that person never gets invited back.
Yeah, that person's boring on
yeah,
TV.
Yeah. That's no fun. Now, we'll see how your acumen is with time. So if you look at 10 years in the U.S. stock market, again, looking at this data from the last 45 years, all the mm-hmm. different rolling 10-year time periods, if you started with $10,000, what do you think is the worst, the absolute worst 10-year time period? You started with $10,000. How much do you end up with 10 years later?
I see. So you start with $10,000, and this happens to be a slice of time, a full decade slice of time, when we did have a massive market crash. So the worst probably, it's not going to be 38%.
And I'll give you a hint. Uh-huh. In this worst 10-year time period, there were two market crashes.
Two market crashes. Okay, so there were 2 years where it might have gone down 30-some-odd percent, but the other years probably rebounded. So I would say maybe 15%.
You're good at this game. It is actually a total loss of 13%.
Okay.
And your $10,000 would turn into $8,703.
Which, you know, if you have $1 million invested, feels, I guess, somewhat devastating, but also most people don't only invest for 10 years.
Well, and that's the whole purpose of long-term investing. Now, let's see, what is the best 10-year time period? You started with $10,000. Mm. 10 years later, you obviously have more. I'm going to give you that hint. What is the total dollar amount you ended up with 10 years later? What's the best 10-year time period?
Probably only... Like the same, it probably mirrors it, the same amount, 13,000 more.
The best is $57,990.
Oof, that's good.
That is real good. And that's because during that 10-year time period, the average return was 19% a year.
Whoa.
So your money went from $10,000 to almost $60,000. It went up six times. So,
oh yeah, that's the crazy thing. I wasn't compounding my interest.
I know
it
because we live in a linear world. When you live your daily life, unless you're doing astrophysics or engineering, maybe we live in a very linear world. So it's hard to think about that. Now, what's interesting?
Yeah, I think of like 13% over the course of 10 years, but it's 13% every year, or in this case, 19% every year.
And it just compounds. Now, the funny thing is, if you go to 15 years, just a little bit longer, the single worst 15-year period, your 10,000 turned into 18,643.
So even if the market is crashing, the longer you extend the periods, the more money you're making.
Yeah, so if you look at a graph, if you look at 1 year, you could have plus 40 or minus 40, these giant bars.
Yeah.
But when you go out to 25 years, the worst average annual rate is around 8%, and the best is around 14%.
Wow.
So the margin of error gets really, really small the longer you go out. So when I make a graph to help people predict how much money they're going to have in the future, it's this weird thing where I'll tell them, in the next year or two, this graph is going to be wildly wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, it might be right, but it's probably going to be wrong. Plus or minus, I have no idea. But when you look out 30 years, it's probably within a few percentage points of being right. And that's bizarre, because normally when you go out further and further in time, you get less and less accurate. With stock market investing, at least based on the data we have, I don't know the future, so all I have is history. Mm-hmm. It gets more and more reliable that you're going to make about 10%.
And the truth is, I mean, we have to look at the history. We have to learn from history and try and make our best possible assumptions about the future based on the past. And it's true. I mean, it's unfortunate that you probably have to give some sort of disclaimer to your clients. They probably have to sign something that says like that they won't hold you accountable if there's some sort of catastrophic, if the stock market itself implodes, you know, while you're helping them with their financial planning.
Well, it's the classic past performance does not guarantee future results.
Yeah, and it can't, but it's going to be our best, I guess, data pool to be able to make those sorts of decisions.
Yeah, and it's all I've got. And matter of fact, I just had a funny thing. A company just sent me a new mutual fund that opened up in January of this year. I get all this weird stuff because I'm in the industry. Mm-hmm. And this mutual fund, if you put in $100,000, it guarantees that it will pay you 1% per month.
Hmm.
Not per year like you can get in your bank if you're lucky, or with a CD. They are going to pay you 1% per month.
How do they guarantee you that?
Because it's in writing. I mean, they're going to give you... Now, there's a little asterisk, right? And if you look at the very bottom of the 18th page, the little asterisk says that, yes, they do pay out 1% a month, but if market conditions are not favorable, the vast majority or all of that money could be return of your principal.
Wait. Let me break this down. If the market's not favorable, then what happens?
So if you put in $100,000, and let's say they make no money and they lose no money, they still send you $1,000 at the end of the month.
Yeah.
Your investment is now $99,000.
Oh, they're taking it out of your own principal.
Yeah, so they're paying you back the principal, which if that's what you want, maybe you should further consider this type of fund, although I don't think so, but for other reasons. But what can easily happen is that you are not really consciously aware that you're getting your own money back, so you spend it.
Yeah, no, for sure. Like, there's no reason to... It seems like the only way that this would be a sound financial plan would be for somebody who needs their own, like, allowance manager.
Right.
Like,
and
somebody
and
who
you only
can't
need
be
money
trusted.
For 5 years.
Exactly. Like, somebody who cannot be trusted with all the money they have under their mattress right now. So they need somebody to dish it back to them in small amounts, which is terrible.
So if this fund for some reason happened to lose 25% over a 2-year time period, and they pay you out 24% over a 2-year time period, if you're not careful, if you didn't know and you didn't read this little asterisk, you would find out 2 years later, you now have an investment that's one half the size.
Oh my God. And this is the crazy thing. Like, I know there's new legislation to help prevent consumers from being, you know, wildly taken advantage of by creditors. But in the case of mutual funds or in the case of investments, you know, there's just so much fine print and it's so complicated, the algorithms that, you know, they're hiring PhDs from Harvard and from Caltech to write up these like really complicated algorithms. And I think we end up getting screwed, the individual investors, because we literally can't understand the math.
Well, that's a wonderful way of saying it. What I'll tell most people is that the industry is designed in such a way that they will make more money from your money than you will, but they have to give you something so you don't notice it. Now, if you want, I can give you some mathematical samples and we can play a little game.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
To show how it works. And if you're driving, pause, come back to this, right? But we're going to do a little math. And of course, if you have a pen and paper, you can play along or we'll try to keep track as we're going. And what you're going to do, Kara, is you're going to invest $100.
Okay.
So you start with $100 and you show up and you meet this advisor who is paid
and
nice...
And this is not you. This is an unscrupulous advisor.
Well, that's a harsh word.
Is an advisor who's doing what the industry standard generally is.
Oh, I like that. Yes, they're getting paid a nice big commission to convince you to buy something that they may or may not themselves understand.
Gotcha.
So I'll derail here for a minute. If you go to a Chevy dealership, mm-hmm. and you ask anyone that works in that dealership, what is better, a Chevy or a Ford truck? What are they going to tell you?
A Chevy.
Of course. And we all know that. But what people don't know, and the industry doesn't necessarily want you to know, when you go to any of the big name places, A.G. Edwards, Edward Jones, Franklin Templeton, it doesn't matter. And you sit down with a person and they make recommendations to you, there may only be 5 or 10 or 12 mutual fund companies that will pay that person a commission.
So of course they're going, it's just like when you go to your doctor and they recommend a certain drug and then you look around and you start seeing all the pens have that drug name on them and the tissue holder has that drug name and oh, their trip to Bermuda was sponsored by that drug.
And you can have that with advisors if they are not a fiduciary, fancy word.
This I wanted to talk about. Can we derail for an even deeper second to
absolutely.
Talk about that fancy word? Okay, good. So we'll come back to the $100 investment in a second.
A fiduciary is someone that has an ethical and a legal responsibility to do what is in your best interest as the client.
Yes, I learned this watching that Frontline episode and like a light bulb went off and it was crazy to me that we don't all know about this. So, and legally they have to answer this question. So if you are sitting down with a financial planner, with an advisor, with a broker, whatever the case may be, you can ask them point blank, are you a fiduciary? And they have to tell you yes or no. And if they like run around the question and they're like, well, I mean, blah, blah, blah. And they no, are you a fiduciary? Yes or no? If they say no, I'm not saying that you should walk away, but I would walk away.
I will say you should walk away.
There you go.
And the problem is 95% of the advisors in the industry are not only not fiduciaries, but they are specifically exempted by law from being a fiduciary.
So, I mean, and that's a real number, right? That's not just a 99% of the time.
Right.
Like, that's a real number.
Here's
literally 95%.
Virtually any insurance agent you meet, virtually any broker, virtually mm-hmm. any advisor that works for the big firms, they get paid commissions, and those commissions can vary from 1 or 2% up to 15% based on what they sell you. Mm-hmm. They are exempted by federal statute from having to provide you a fiduciary advice. What they have to do is provide you reasonable investments.
Yeah, which just means that they're not like totally taking advantage of you, which means that they're not trying to sell you something that's like illegal.
Well, yeah, there are other laws that they have to follow, but But
they don't have to. They don't have to sell you a product, or they don't have to advise you to invest in a way that is most beneficial for your long-term savings. That's insane to me.
It is. And the funny thing, like I was talking about, they don't even have to know if it's good for you. What they are paid to do is sell products. The person that makes the most money is the best salesperson. They do not get any financial benefit for knowing what the fuck they're doing. They get financial benefit for being salespeople. And that's not necessarily bad, but it becomes buyer beware. It's you versus them. So you'll hear things like, look, I don't think the actuarials really understand the benefit of this program. Matter of fact, I would not be surprised if in a few weeks the company pulls this off the market. If you don't get this today, you're not going to be able to get in on the ground floor on this bad boy.
Oh, my God. And that's totally legal for them to say something like that.
Well, of course. To the best of my knowledge, I am not an attorney. But,
sure.
You know, whenever someone talks to you about an investment and they say, if you don't get this, it's going to go away, you should walk.
Yeah, because it seems like the only time when that would be true is if they're giving you insider knowledge and then they're committing a felony.
So. Good point. The other things that I'll tell people, not only is the fiduciary question a lovely question, but ask them, what do they get paid? And since I brought it up, I will start by saying I get 1% per year of assets under management. You can decide that that's way too fucking expensive and you don't want to pay it. Okay, but you know up front.
So when you say assets per management or assets under management, that means that 1% of what anybody has in their holdings at the end of the year or however you calculate it multiple times
right,
a year.
Right, so if someone has $100,000, I would get $1,000 for that year for helping them.
There you go.
Some people think that's too expensive and they don't hire me. That's mm-hmm. fine. And it's just like people tell me I could change my own oil in my car. No. It's not going to happen. I'll go to the quick lube place and I'll pay them. And I don't really care what they want. I'm going to pay them because I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
There are people who really, really get involved with their own investments. It doesn't make sense necessarily for them to pay. But there are other people who go, Phil, I am married. I have kids. I've got a full-time job. I've got other obligations and requirements. I don't have time to learn all the things that you have learned. Just mm-hmm. like I don't have time to make my own freaking shirts.
Yeah.
You pay someone to help you with that service or that product. And we all specialize in things, and that's how we get through life.
So true. I have a housekeeper. I'm not afraid to admit it. It was like my first goal. I always said, when I can afford to pay somebody to clean my house, I will never clean my house again. And although I'm a very clean, tidy person and everything's always put away and organized, I would never leave actual messes out for the housekeeper. I can't remember the last time that I did a deep scrub of my kitchen. It's just not my priority. Well, you know what I mean?
Neither can I, and I don't have a maid. See how that works?
There are different things, you know, there are different things that people want to put, because when you get to a certain point in your career, time equals money, and you do start to calculate out, what am I skilled at, what is worth it for me to just pay for, and what is worth it for me to save a little money and do it myself. Like, we are working on a new house right now. My boyfriend and I bought a new house, and we're doing major renovations in this home. And we haven't lifted a finger. We didn't do the demo. We're not like chipping in to help lay the tile. We're paying our contractor for it. And yes, I know it's expensive, but at the same time, I also know it's being done right. Because if I was trying to DIY this shit, oof, I would not want to see the outcome of that.
You know, the one thing that I do that my wife, she just can't wrap her head around the fact that I do this. I like mowing the lawn.
I know a lot of guys like that. And I like to do laundry, which is also kind of weird.
And it's weird for me, because when I'm mowing the lawn, there is nothing else mm-hmm. but mowing the lawn. It is loud. It is potentially dangerous. You know, you could lose toes.
Yeah, and it smells good.
Yeah, I do like that smell. And you're mm-hmm. focused on making this one little strip. And when you come back, you got to match up the wheels just right to make the next little strip. And it kind of consumes my activity it's about an hour. I don't have that big a yard.
Yeah.
But for that hour, there's no worries, there's no problems, there's no paperwork I have to get done, there's no calls I have to return. I'm simply mowing the lawn, and for an hour, I'm basically Forrest Gump.
I love that. You know, I co-host now The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. I've been doing it for about a month or two.
No way.
And, no way. And it's been so much fun. And
you know what's weird?
What?
We've talked about your other podcast and we've never mentioned mine, and I'm the guest.
Which one? Oh, the Phil Ferguson show? We mentioned it right at the beginning.
Oh, maybe it's not been enough.
We'll mention it more.
Okay.
So this week when I was on the Phil Ferguson show, I did bring up Skeptic's Guide. But what I was going to say about Skeptic's Guide is that they're, now that I'm a co-host, I'm on the email list. So when people go through the contact form on the website to give feedback, I see all those emails. And we got one recently from a fan who was saying that he has a ritual of listening to the show every week when he mows the lawn. And now he has this very interesting Pavlovian response that when he hears the theme music, he smells freshly cut grass.
That's trippy.
Isn't that lovely? It's just such a wonderful, I don't know, I was just so happy when I heard that.
I do worry, though, because the only way you could listen to a podcast while mowing a lawn is by having noise-canceling headphones. And
yeah.
Now you're not paying attention to your surroundings while using heavy equipment.
That's probably true.
I'm just saying. Hey, so you know what?
What?
You want to invest $100.
Yes, I want to invest $100. Okay, so I have $100 and I go to not an unscrupulous financial planner, but a non-fiduciary. So somebody whose only real obligation is to give a reasonable investment, which probably just means it's not going to break you, and to make as much money as he possibly can, he or she, working for a large investment firm. So that's where I am right now.
Right. Now, the thing that they tell you about this, it's called a guaranteed mutual fund.
Okay. So that sounds comforting to me.
It does, and it should be, because your $100, which we'll call the principal, is guaranteed. You cannot lose it.
I can't lose my principal. That sounds great.
In the next 10 years, this is going to pay you 40% return. And on $100, that's $40, 4% per year, guaranteed.
Okay. That also sounds
great
because now, it's guaranteed.
In today's environment where a short-term bond fund might pay you 2%, 4% sounds like a pretty good deal.
Sure. And we'll just ignore the whole conversation we had previously about the market averaging 10%.
That's right. Wink, wink. Well, I mean, maybe you're close to retirement and you want to make sure you've got this money.
Yes. Like 10 years is, maybe I am 55 already and I say I want to retire at 65 with my $100. Oh, no.
It could happen. You might actually live that long. So
I hope this is not all the money I have to invest at 55.
Yes, but we're making we could make it a bigger scale, but this is good fun for $100. Now, when I do this at a talk at a convention, skeptic or atheist conventions, which by the way, listeners, I'm cheap. You can have me, just pay for my airfare and my hotel. I'll come talk anywhere you want. You've got this $100.
Uh-huh.
And now they also will tell you that the vast majority of this money is in government bonds.
Okay, so, which sounds secure.
As long as the government taxes people, it'll get paid back. And a little bit of it is in the stock market. You could make even more than the 4%.
Gotcha. That 4% is my minimum.
That's your minimum. So what do you think?
It.
You ready to invest?
Yeah, sounds good.
Now, one of the questions I tell people to ask this advisor, of course, we have the fiduciary rule. If they're trying to pressure you, that's a problem. One of the things I love is you ask the advisor, what do they get paid if you do this?
Ah, okay. So what do you get paid if I go ahead and make this investment?
Now, if they start giving you an answer that sounds something like Bill Clinton talking about Monica Lewinsky, it's again time to leave.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is often they genuinely cannot tell you because they don't know. Because it can be so complicated, they just know the more of these they sell, the more money they make.
They just know at the end of the year, there's this formula and then I have some dollars.
And they may even be that they get 8% or 10% commission on this. And if they sell 5 of them in the next 30 days, they get a week-long vacation in Tahiti.
Yeah.
And so how does one calculate that numerically when the client or prospective client asks? Now, that's the good stuff the salesperson told you. Oh, and by the way, they gave you a 72-page prospectus. And the very back page, you rip out and you sign that you read the whole thing and you hand it over to the salesperson.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this is longer than the Microsoft Windows agreement.
Oh, yeah, or any iTunes agreement.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, yeah, sure, I read that. Like, I've used it before. It's fine.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like every week there's an update, and you have to say, I agree. Terms and conditions may apply, people.
Yeah,
go watch ahead it. Cullen Hoback.
Track
really
my
good.
Listening data, whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, one of the beautiful things about the financial services world is they can do almost anything. That's my hedge word. They can do almost anything to you as long as they disclose it in the prospectus.
Sure, yeah, and they can disclose it in the most legalese way possible.
In 6-point font.
Yeah.
So now, the first thing that the salesperson may have forgotten to mention, it's a simple oversight. There's no requirement that they tell you, but this investment that you bought has a load. You know what a load is?
Something. It sounds like some uneven way that it's either dispersed or taken, that there's something big at the beginning or at the end.
Oh, well, it can be the beginning or the end. In this case, it's the beginning. And I'll tell people, think of a load of crap.
It's just a load of shit. That's the easiest way to remember. Right.
So at the beginning of this investment, you, Cara Santa Maria, has to pay an 8% load.
Oh, I see. So I'm investing $100, but $8 of that have to go right off the top, or I have to pay an extra $8 on top of it.
Well, so now here's the way I like to look at it. You start with $100, and how much do you expect 10 years later?
$140. Because it's $4 every year.
Right. Well, it's really $3.3 every year compounded, but shh.
Okay.
The salesperson doesn't have to understand math. They have to sell.
So
you pay this load of $8. That comes out of your $100.
Gotcha. So right off the bat, I really only have $92 because the $8 is a fee.
So you're good. So what I'll normally do when I do this in front of a crowd to make it entertaining is I'll hand Monopoly money. So I'll give them the $140 because that's what they expect to have 10 years later. And now I'll make them give me $8 of the Monopoly money back.
Right at the beginning. So now that's $132.
Right. See how quick she did that, everybody? Just right, bam. You didn't have a calculator, did you?
I did not.
Wow, that was great.
I might need one later in this exercise, though.
You cannot work at a Speedway in Arkansas. You're too good with math. So now, how much do you make on this reinvestment in 10 years minimum?
Oh, on the 132?
No. I told you at the beginning you were going to make
140. Right. Oh, I'm going to make 40.
Okay. You're not going to make 40.
No. Okay.
You know why?
Shit, because now I'm only starting with 132.
Well,
or with the 92.
Exactly. So you're not really going to make 40. You're only going to make $37, which is roughly, we're rounding here, 40% of 92. So you have to give me another $3.
Yeah, okay. So now I'm down to 129.
Right, yeah, but you know, this investment is so good that even if you notice this, you don't mind.
No, because I still have 29 extra dollars. That's 29 more than I had when I started.
And you'll get that 29 at the end. You don't get it in the interim because here's the funny thing. You'll love this. You'll think this is funny. Genuinely, you will. If you pull out early, like a good Catholic, you will lose 10% of your money.
Yeah. That's pretty common, isn't it?
Oh, it's very common with products. So you want to invest, but you don't want to get a product. And usually what I'll tell people, the more complicated the investment or the product is, the less likely you are going to want it. So I tell people to follow the KISS model. Keep it simple, silly. If you don't understand it, don't invest in it. So now, this money is invested. It's invested in mutual funds. The average mutual fund expense ratio currently in the United States is 1.5 to 1.6. These funds are 1.8.
Ooh, so they're higher than average.
They're a little higher than average, but you know what? This is such a wonderful investment, you don't mind.
Okay, so what does this mean, 1.8? Does that mean I have to pay them 1.8% a year?
You do, and you're going to pay it for 10 years because the 10% penalty terrifies you, and so now you have to give me another $18.
Okay, so now I'm down to, what is that, 119? I can't do math because I'm tired. That's where am I?
I think 111. Is
11.
That 111?
Yeah.
Okay. So now here's the funny thing. I told you the money was guaranteed and the returns are guaranteed.
Yeah, but right now I only have $11 more than I had when I started.
And this is where they would say, don't worry your pretty little head.
Okay.
Now
I'm sick, so I'm just going to trust you.
That's right. So when you guarantee something's value, what you're basically doing is insuring it. Like your car or your house, you buy insurance for that. And of course, there's a fee for that.
Okay.
I mean, it makes sense. I mean, that no one would expect a guarantee without some kind of fee. That's just 1.5% per year.
Shit.
So it's another $15.
Okay, so then you take the 11 off at 100. Now we're dipping below my original principal. So now I'm at $96.
You are. Now, here's the next funny thing. And this one, it's great. You're gonna really appreciate this. I think you will. I told you the vast majority of the money was invested in zero or in U.S. bonds, but I didn't tell you they were zero coupon U.S. bonds.
I don't know what that means.
Nobody does. And that's part of the charm. So a normal bond, when you buy it in 6 months or 12 months, once a year or twice a year, there's other variations, but that's the norm, they will pay you an interest rate.
Yeah.
1-5%, depending on the risk and term of the bond. With zero coupon bonds, you don't buy it at face value. You buy it at a discount, and then you later sell it back to the government at a higher price.
I buy it at a discount, and then I pay it back at a higher price. Okay, that sounds like a good deal.
It's not necessarily bad, but many years ago, the IRS decided that they didn't want to wait for you to pay taxes until you sold the bond back, so they created a whole new type of tax called imputed interest.
So it's interest I owe on the money that I don't have yet?
Oh, you're good. You are so good at this game. Yes, you have to pay tax on money you don't yet have.
What so the fuck?
Virtually no one would, in their right mind, ever buy a zero coupon bond, because every year you have to pay tax on money you have not received yet.
Oh my God.
So you're paying taxes on profits you have not realized. So you might pay taxes every year for a decade and then at the end of the decade make the money. Nobody wants to do that.
No, that sounds like a bad idea. Yeah. But you don't get double taxed, right?
Once
you get the money, you don't have to pay taxes on
right.
it again. Okay,
but
that's good.
The beautiful thing about this, and the reason that companies will put these inside of products, is because they will be able to sell and keep the gains, and you pay the taxes.
Oh my God, that's so
because they promised you 4% a year. So that is a really small fee. That is just 0.8% per year.
Okay, so that's one. That's it rounds up.
$8.
$8. Okay, so now I'm down to, let's see, $84. That's a lot less than I started.
Yeah.
Oh, not 84. $84.
It'll be
no.
88.
88, you're right. Jeez, that was 12.
No, it's okay.
$88, that's way less than I started with.
And so people will then ask me this, saying, well, this is completely made up and fictional. Well, this is not an actual very specific product, but if you go to the Google and if you go to FINRA, which is the watchdog organization for the investment industry, which
that's
is
F-I-N-R-A?
F-I-N-R-A.
Okay.
Which is cleverly staffed by people in the industry.
Uh-huh.
They actually have an investor warning page where they detail all this information. So again, with science-based investing, you can go double check what I'm saying and you can go look this up, and they will go through these same steps. They use slightly different numbers, and I'm rounding and I'm simplifying it a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but you can go double check. But who has ever gone to the FINRA investor warning page?
Who has even heard of FINRA?
Well, I have, but that's different. So the group that oversees the investment industry tells people not to buy the products that many of their members currently sell.
And that's, you know what? This is the biggest interesting thing that I learned when I watched this Frontline episode, was that towards the end of it, this is where the real investigative reporting came in. They were asking the individual salespeople and even the presidents of these mutual fund companies, are you invested in these products? And they were like hemming and hawing. And then when they actually looked at their investment records, none of them actually bought the products they sold because they were bad products and they knew it.
Well, you're right, they often will not. But a good salesperson would put maybe $3,000 or $5,000 or $10,000 into one of these things.
So they could say that they were invested.
Right. So if someone says, have you ever put any of your money in this? And they go, yeah, actually, I own one of these myself. And they go, oh, okay, it must be great.
Yeah.
So, of course, they could just lie, but it's not
Let's hope they wouldn't do that.
Yeah, it's not that hard for them to buy a small one and say that they have it. And on my show, virtually every week, because sometimes I get off on a political rant or something else about abortion and Planned Parenthood, but almost every week, I'm talking about something like this, and I've done a show on long-term healthcare insurance. So when you're old and gray, and you don't want to spend your entire portfolio, have it flushed down the toilet on a nursing home, you can buy long-term care insurance. And I go through all of the mathematics behind that for about 20, 25 minutes explaining to you how those work.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, and also, what about reverse mortgages?
It's on my list of to-do, but you know, there's no end in things. I've done things, viaticals. You ever heard of those?
No, but that sounds like a boner pill. It's not a boner pill.
Well, you're going to really hate when I tell you what it is.
What is it?
It is when you buy life insurance of someone who is terminally ill before they die.
That's so fucked up. That's legal?
It's not only legal, it is not necessarily a bad idea.
Oh. Ooh.
No, hang on.
I feel about that.
It's not a bad idea conceptually.
Yeah, okay.
But as for you, the individual investor, you will get fucked. So don't ever buy one of these. But it just sounds evil.
Let me
give you a reason why it's not necessarily evil. Okay. Say I have been diagnosed with AIDS and I'm going to die in 2 years.
Yes.
I cannot afford AIDS medicine.
Okay.
But I have $1 million life insurance policy.
I see. And then if I can cover your meds.
Well, no. What I do is I sell you my life insurance policy and you become the beneficiary. So Cara Santa Maria gets $1 million when I die.
Mm-hmm.
And what you have to do in the meantime, you pay me
$600,000. Oh, so that you can cover everything.
Right. And then it's my money. I can go on vacations. I can buy the medicine. It's not your concern. I do whatever. Matter of fact, if I don't buy the medicine, it's better for Cara because I'm going to die sooner.
But, Jesus Christ.
But then what happens is there's a medical advancement and I live 8 years.
Yeah.
And Kara calls up Phil and says, hey, Phil, how you doing? You feeling okay? That's when it gets weird.
Well, it gets weird anyway because I don't want to hope that you're going to die, Phil.
And what generally happens is that you'll get a broker. So someone will come and be in the middle and they will buy the life insurance policy for $500,000. And they'll sell it to you for $800,000, and they guarantee you 20% return on your investment.
Okay.
Which is true. You paid actually it's 22%, 25%, depending on how you do the math. But you might get that in 3 weeks. You might get it in 15 years. And if in the meantime, the person keeps living, guess who makes the insurance premium payments?
Who?
Cara Santa Maria.
Oh.
Guess what happens if Kara misses a payment on the life insurance policy?
My credit gets fucked?
No. The policy is voided and you get $0.
Oh.
And you paid $800,000 for this and you could get $0 if you miss one payment.
I didn't want to do it anyway because it sounded immoral.
Well, like I said, if you're that person that has $1 million of life insurance and you could use $500,000 or $600,000 or $700,000 today to make your life better, it's not necessarily bad.
Yeah, not for the person who needs the money.
Yeah. And so whenever there's someone who needs money and someone who needs more money later, you do have the possibility of making a transaction that could benefit both parties. But it generally doesn't work that way because the middleman is the one who flips the contract and makes 10, 20, 30% in a couple of days. The insured gets their money and you buy the viatical and you may or may not get your money whenever.
Viatical. You know, it sounds to me like this is in the same kind of umbrella group as the commercials you'll see late at night on reverse mortgages. The commercials you'll see late at night for the quote-unquote lending agencies where somebody has some sort of medical claim coming to them, some sort of like legal amount of money coming to them, but it's on a per year basis.
Right.
Have you seen those? Like, it's my money and I want it now. And there's some, you know, middleman who will give you your entire thing at a much lower rate and then they'll collect.
Right. And matter of fact,
I mean, there's so many things like this, even just like a down, you know, a corner payday loan kind of place. These are predatory.
They are predatory. And I haven't done payday loan, which I need to. I haven't done what you've just described. But I've also done a thing called return of premium term life insurance. So you buy life insurance, and if you never use it, you get all your money back.
And how do you never use your own life insurance?
Because you buy life insurance for 30 years while you have kids and you're young and you're married.
I see.
And you pay all this money, and you start when you're 25, and when you're 55 and your kids are grown up, and you don't need life insurance anymore because now you have a portfolio worth $500,000 or $2 million, they give you all the money back that you paid the premiums with.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
It does, and it sells like hotcakes.
Yeah.
But what the person who buys this fails to consider is the time value of money. You could have invested that money yourself for 30 years and made a lot more money with it.
I see. And even you know, just cost of living and inflation is actually happening too.
Yep.
So
your money
devalues. Your money's actually worth less after 30 years than it would be. It's worth less under your mattress than it is even in your bank.
And I did a whole, and this was one of the toughest ones. I did one on how annuities work.
And
it was 23 minutes of mathematics, and I was scared when I did it, but I don't have average listeners at the Phil Ferguson Show. And this has been the most complimented show I've ever done on anything, because if you listen to all the experts, you know, Susie Orman, Bob Brinker, Dave Ramsey, they will often say, don't get an annuity, don't get an annuity, don't get an annuity. But they don't go through the detail of why you don't want to get an annuity.
Their producers would never let them, you know, fill up airtime on, you know,
right,
television.
What show can appeal to the mass market with 23 minutes of mathematics?
Which is why instead Susie Orman is just yelling at people whether they can afford it or not, which is kind of great. You have to.
Yeah, it's good entertainment. So that's why I was scared to make this episode. But when I did, I had people emailing me and calling me and finding me or seeing me at conferences, and they go, I've heard for 20 years that annuities are bad, but I never had anyone explain why. And I listened to your 23-minute segment, and it was like, oh my God, that's fucking evilly, brilliantly, genius, fucked up mess. But it makes sense how you can still make some money in an annuity, but the company will make more off of your money than you ever did. It's beautiful.
And I think that's the great thing about podcasting, and the great thing about having this direct connection to our very specific fans and listeners, is that you can be wonky about the things that you know they want you to be wonky about, and you can really speak to their individual interests, as opposed to, you know, I work full time on television. That's really, when I say I'm a freelance science communicator, the bulk of my income comes from the work that I do on TV. And I know what it's like to do the television shows that I do, which I love doing, but I get frustrated because I can't ever do deep dives. You just can't.
Yeah.
It's not the format.
It's not the mass appeal.
Yeah.
If you want, I've got another story for you.
I love stories.
You love stories. Well, someone came to me, and let's call her Mary.
Okay.
And she said one of the most terrifying things I've ever heard in my life.
What did Mary say?
She said, Phil, I followed your advice.
And you're like, oh God, how did it turn out?
Well, and my first thought was, no, you didn't, because part of my advice is hiring me and Polaris Financial Planning, my company. So she didn't do that. And I go, oh God, what did you do? And she says, I bought a stock. And I go, A stock. Now, one of my general rules of thumb is you should never have more than 5% of your portfolio in any specific stock. I like index funds where you have hundreds, if not thousands, of companies. But she bought $5,000 in one individual stock.
When did you give her that advice?
I never did. And that's the beauty of when someone says, I just bought a stock. Or, yeah, I followed your advice. Now, the next thing she tells me, hey, you know what? I got it for half price.
What? What does that even mean?
I know, right? And I'm like, what do you mean?
It's not like a physical thing that has a
There is no half price in stocks. I mean, whatever two people agree to buy or sell a stock for, and that comes across on the bottom of your screen when you're watching CNBC, the ticker price, that is the value of the stock at that moment. Mm-hmm. When two other parties agree on that price or another price, that's the new price.
If you buy something at half price, most likely that means that you bought something after it lost value.
Well, and it's funny because what people do is they get really excited when stocks go up. So I'll give them this example. If you go into a store and I don't know, it's a sweater or a suit or a dress, whatever you want to buy, and you're looking at it and you're like, oh, that's really nice, but it's $400. And you go, yeah. Man, I don't know. That's a lot of money. I'm going to think about it. And I'm going to come back. And a year later, you'll go back and that very same item is now $800. So you buy it.
Okay. Wait, how much was it before?
$400.
Wait, why would I buy it at $800?
You wouldn't. But when people look at stocks and a stock goes from $100 to $200, they want to buy it.
No, that's when you want to have had bought it.
I know. It's like you would have been freaking genius if you bought it a year ago. Now, if you have some reason to believe through diligent research and study that it's going to be worth more than $200 in some future time, fine, we can have that conversation. But if you buy it because it went from $100 to $200, that's nonsensical. And and when I give that example in reference to a clothing item, it's obviously silly.
That's why I had to stop and re-ask because I was like, I thought I was listening.
Yeah. So that's one of the things I try to do is try to reframe these concepts. So when she says she bought a stock at half of the price, my first thought is, how in the fuck could you say that out loud to me? That means you have no fucking clue what you're talking about. So we
and
go.
And you were not listening to the Phil Ferguson show.
So we go and look up this company and you can check this yourself. It's, I think, because the company doesn't exist anymore. Spoilers. And it was called SEFE Incorporated. I don't know how you pronounce it, but it's SEFE Incorporated. And I pull up the screen with all these numbers and bids and asks and close and volume and charts and data and all this stuff. And as I'm looking at this, she goes, yeah, I looked at something like that, but I don't understand what any of this stuff means.
Well, yeah.
So why did you hand someone $5,000? Well, it was half price.
That's such the scary thing too, right? It's just one of those things where we like to talk in the skeptic community about being fully informed about every decision that you make, about everything being evidence-based and about looking at the science behind everything that we do so that we can ensure that we're not making decisions based on emotion, that we're not making decisions based on appeals to authority. Unfortunately, we were just talking about it. I have a housekeeper, you know, you will pay somebody to do something other than mow your lawn. And when it comes down to it, there's simply not enough time in the day to be an expert about everything, which is why I think we have to then have a secondary obligation to ourselves to ensure that the experts that we talk to have the same ethos as we do.
Yeah, it's really helpful. And it's funny because as we were looking at this chart, it turns out that the last transaction of the stock was at 32 cents. She paid 50 cents, which was half off the dollar. Now, the next thing that was hysterical is most companies, when they go public or if they issue new shares, there's a fixed number of shares that they have to sell. Mm-hmm. This company was involved in a totally legal process of continuous share sales.
What does that mean?
That means they can keep selling shares as long as they keep finding buyers for the shares. They just print money.
Oh, shit. How is that legal?
Because it is.
How is everything you're telling me today legal?
Well, buyer beware. It's a libertarian world out there in financial services industry.
So scary.
And so she bought this, and the last transaction that had occurred was for the entire month was less than 5,000 shares. She now owns 10,000 shares because she paid $5,000 for 50 cents. If she goes to sell her shares, she runs the risk of depressing the market value of the stock below 32, and she just paid 50 for it.
Oh my God.
So she might lose 25 to 30% of her money, maybe half. Oh, and do you ever see the movie Wolf of Wall Street?
I still haven't seen it, but I know exactly the movie you're talking
so,
about.
So for the listeners, this is one of those pink sheets, over-the-counter, penny stock kind of things, where the broker's commission, by law, is limited. Guess what the maximum percentage they can make in commission is?
10%?
50.
What the fuck?
So he sold the stock allegedly for $5,000. I do not know what his commission was, but the most it could be is $2,500.
Oh my God.
Now, I go to this company's website, which is no longer available, but thankfully I took screenshots because this was a couple years ago. And you have some skeptic listeners. We talked about that already. Let me read to you what they do.
Okay.
They are developing, and I quote, a proprietary technology to harvest the constant and powerful static electricity that is continually formed in the Earth's atmosphere.
Okay.
And they go on. With a high-altitude weather balloon and a conductive cable in constant contact with a ground unit.
Wait, they made an antenna?
What they do, they're working on a technology, a proprietary patentable technology, to take weather balloons. Have you ever seen a weather balloon? You probably have.
Yeah.
You know what they're made of?
Oh, what are they made of?
Well, it's
like Mylar or something,
it's
right?
It's phenomenally thin polymers or metals, and they float it up with helium.
Like almost to the edge of space. Like they go really high.
Right. And they're going to attach to that a 4 or 5 or 10 mile long cable. And if there's a variation in static electricity between 5 miles up and the ground, it's somehow going to like charge a giant battery. And they show this cable coming down and plugging into a city that's floating because it's the future.
Yep.
Now, do you know what happened? You know this. Your listeners probably know this. When is the time that you have a large static variance between the upper and lower atmosphere?
During a thunderstorm?
How do weather balloons do in thunderstorms?
Probably not so well.
Not so well. So when this thing shreds, it's going to drop a 5 mile long cable to the ground.
That's safe. That sounds safe.
What could go wrong?
I love it. So it is basically just a giant lightning rod.
It's a giant lightning rod that cannot possibly work more than one time because it's going to get destroyed. And so as I'm looking at this, I see red flag, red flag, red flag,
yeah, so
red
basically,
flag, red flag.
They looked at like a elementary school kind of science fair proposal, and then they sort of beefed up the website and were hoping that people wouldn't notice.
And there's three owners of this company, and they had sold $30 million worth of stock.
Oh my God.
Now, what they do is they hire a couple of scientists for a year or two to do research to see if this is feasible and pay them a couple hundred grand each.
And then when they find out that it's not feasible.
And when they find out it's not feasible, and of course, in the meantime, during these 3 years, the three owners each paid themselves $5 million a year. I don't have that number. I'm just making it up for the scenario's sake.
But sure, I'm sure they gave themselves a salary.
Yeah, they paid themselves a generous salary, and then they go, oh gosh, our research has failed, and now we're not selling any more shares. We've run out of money. The company files bankruptcy. The three owners get to keep their salaries, and they go on and do something else.
Good Christ.
So, what did we say? Mary.
Mary.
As I'm looking at all this, and I said, okay, Mary, you have a problem. You're never going to get this money back. You can kiss it goodbye. Mm-hmm. Now, I said, here's what you do. You call the broker back and you say, look, I did some research. I figured out this is crap. Give me my $5,000 back.
Mm-hmm.
He will, of course, say, no. That's
He'll
not.
He'll say, I already cashed out my $2,500.
Yeah, that's not how investing works.
Yeah.
And you say, this is not investing. This is a fucking scam. And you either give me the $5,000, you put your boss on the phone, or I'm going to bring my sorry ass down there and talk to your boss. And if he doesn't give me the $5,000, I'm going to the state SEC and I'm going to file a formal complaint against your ass. And they go, hold on, please. Right?
Hold, please.
And they'll give her back her $5,000. Now, keep in mind, that Mary is a friend of the family, and she was in the middle of a divorce.
Sure, and that's the thing.
Well, let me flesh this all out, because you're going to love it. She's in the middle of a divorce because her husband got caught stealing from his employer and using the money on hookers and blow. I kid you not. One of the kids found the open website where he's booking hookers.
Oh, poor Mary. So Mary's very distraught.
And she didn't want to divorce him. They went to the Saddleback Church in California, and they said, you cannot get divorced. It's a sin. So they stayed married. He got caught again. So now he's in jail because he can't pay back the millions of dollars that he borrowed. And she decided to stop paying the mortgage because they were about to repossess her very, very nice house. And she had managed to save up $5,000 so that she could afford rent in an apartment.
Oh, Mary.
And she just gave all $5,000 to this broker to buy the stock that was going to double.
She was upside down on her mortgage too, I'm assuming. That's why she didn't just sell her house.
There was no way to get out of it. So she just stopped paying the mortgage. Not the legally responsible thing to do, but not unreasonable human thing to do. So she was pocketing the mortgage money so that she could pay for an apartment. So while she's, you know, kissing her husband and he's going off to jail and now getting a divorce and her house is going to be taken away from her in a few weeks, she takes every single penny that she has and buys this stock. And I explain to her what to do. And she goes, I could never do that.
What?
And I go, well, you know, maybe she's just shy and she doesn't want to do it. And I said, I'll go with you. Right?
Yeah.
Right? And she goes, I can't. I don't want to ruin his reputation because he's a member of my church.
Oh, my God. He's ruining his own reputation, Mary.
And the funny thing is, because he's in her church, I would bet you money he knew of her situation. And he knew that this money was going to be a loss. And he knew that it would totally ruin her life. But he saw a way to make $2,500.
Yeah, and I'm sure that it's reinforced that, you know, the ethos of the company reinforces that this is a noble thing to do, that this is important. And this is what you were mentioning earlier, which I think was an important point, is that a lot of times these are just salespeople, right? These are not the people who are writing the algorithms. These are not the Harvard graduates who know a lot about mathematics. These are salespeople who are told that if they sell this thing, and I'm sure are told this is very good for your client, that then they'll make money. And it's very easy to kind of plug your ears when everybody around you is telling you that this is all for the best, that everybody is going to come out on top.
And I remember,
I mean, this is boiler room.
Yeah. That's another great example. And I remember years and years ago, because I've been doing my business for 20 years. But before I started my own, I had an interview with a company. I don't even remember who it was. But that was when I learned during the interview that different products have different commission rates. And I remember coming home and telling my wife, I said, well, if someone comes in with $100,000 that their aunt leaves them, and I help them, and I have my air quotes up, invest.
Yeah.
Do I want to put them in the thing that pays me 3% commission, $3,000, or do I want to put them in the thing that pays 10% commission where I can make $10,000 from one sales call? What am I going to do?
And it's like, you think about it from the perspective of the consumer, where is that commission money coming from? It's coming from the profits that they are making off of all of these people investing.
Oh, absolutely.
So if these salespeople are making money off of your money, how are you expected to make equal or more money off of your money? You know, I hate it when people, we do this all the time, but we can't see that the pie is only so large.
Yeah.
And that the more that we take out, the less there is for what's necessary.
I had this great situation just like a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago. I'm in the line at the grocery store just buying, you know, bread and milk, something real simple. And the guy behind me starts up a random conversation, which always kind of scares me when I'm with just the general public. And he tells me that I hand him my card because he asked what I do. I hand him my card. I happen to have one, which I should always do, but I often don't. But I had one this time. And he goes, oh, he says, my dad died a little bit over a year ago and left me $600,000.
Wow.
And my first thought, sadly, was, ooh, $600,000.
Yeah.
Now, thankfully, I had enough scruples and enough composure to say, that is not the decent human thing to think about or to say. But I pulled it together and I said, I'm sorry for your loss. Right? That, and I'm like, okay. I rose to the occasion. I did the right thing. I said, I'm sorry for loss. And he says, that's okay. I bought an annuity. And I go, how do I explain, or do I even try to explain to a guy in the next 30 seconds, right? And so he put the $600,000 in the annuity. And then before I can even decide if I want to tell him that he just got screwed, he tells me he got a signing bonus.
Oh, God.
Now, I've done this 20 years. I've never heard of a signing bonus, at least not called that way. And I go, what? And he says, yeah, they gave me a $15,000 signing bonus. And I'm like,
it's your own money.
Yeah, in my head, I'm screaming, fucker, you didn't get picked for the NFL draft. They're not giving you a fucking, the $15,000 they gave you is your money.
It's like when you see these commercials all the time for car loans. Where it's like, and they're like big company, the Chevy dealership down the street, come down and we'll give you $3,000 consumer cash. It's like, that's just your money that they're giving right back to you.
That is. So I'm so stunned. And then he tells me that last year, and this was for the calendar year of 2013, he's so incredibly ecstatic that he made, what was the number he said? He made $50,000.
Oh, no. That was his, total income.
Well, that was what he got from the annuity.
Oh, okay.
Right? Now, this seemed like a normal, average working guy who's probably making between $30,000 and $60,000. And even if you make $100,000 or $200,000, an extra $50,000.
That's a lot of money.
That's real money.
Yeah, that's an awful lot of money.
So he made on $600,000, that's what, 8%? Because 10% would be 60. Yeah, it's 8%. So he made 8%. And he thinks not only did he get a $15,000 signing bonus, but he made 8% in 1 year. This guy's killing it. He's ripping it up. I did not have the heart to tell him that in 2013, the stock market went up 32%.
Oh, shit.
So when the market went up 8, his perk, his benefit for that was... Oh, wait, did I say that right? When the market went up 32%, he makes 8.
So he lost a lot of
money. So I just go, hey, that's great to hear. I pick up my bags and I leave.
Yeah, kind of like if you ever, want to talk about your other options.
Yeah, but I mean, it's one of those things that I once had a talk, and listeners may appreciate this, in front of a Christian women's group. Mm-hmm. And they called me a week out and they said, what's your talk about? And I said, I do consumer advocacy and I explain to people how there's a lot of bad investments and how people can get ripped off and all that stuff. And they go, oh, you know what? You're probably not going to be a good speaker for our group.
What?
I'm like, what do you mean? And it's, well, most of our women are 55 to 75 years old and they've already made their investment choices. So if you come in and tell them that they've been ripped off, you're just going to upset them.
That's a tough one. I mean, it's kind of like, what do you do with that guy? Can you really tell him to get out?
Yeah.
And do people have legal recourse to get out?
Well, it depends on the investments. Usually, with an annuity, as long as it has not annuitized, you can get out of it. But there's often a penalty because you made a contractual agreement. Like this guy with a $15,000 signing bonus, if after 2 years he decides he doesn't want it, he may have to give back the $15,000 because that's only contingent on him staying 10 years. And there's a 10% penalty for getting out of $60,000.
Yeah.
He'll never do that.
No, because there goes everything he earned.
Yeah.
In that 1 year.
Even if you could explain mathematically in the long run, he's going to be better off. He'll never, never.
Well, and he also probably physically can't afford to. And that's the real problem is that once they've got you by the balls, you can't make... We can always think about trying to make the smartest kind of long-term mathematical decision, but it's always contingent on whether we can physically afford to do it, which is kind of a big bummer. Hey, Phil.
Yo.
We've been going a long time, man. I just realized we are not just out of time, we are over time.
Oh,
which
my God.
Appreciate. I love these long conversations. We had so much fun. I want to have you back on, especially after you've been able to cover some of those other topics that we talked about. I really think that my listening audience has enjoyed it too. But before we go, I have to ask you the same two questions I ask everybody at the end of my podcast.
Talk to me. I'll pretend like I have no idea what's coming up.
Awesome. So the first one is, when you think about the future, what is the thing that you are most concerned about? And on the flip side of that, what are you most looking forward to?
Most concerned about, well, it's funny because one of the things that drives me is, quite frankly, my own insecurity and my irrational fear that I won't have enough money.
I love that. That's like, well, you know, we're peering into the soul of a financial planner.
Yeah, it's funny because, and I know we're long, but now I have to tell the story, so forgive me.
No, do it. Not at all.
My dad, when I grew up, I knew my dad was a stock picking genius. I mean, we would hear about the stocks that doubled, tripled, went up 10 times. And when I came back home for my first year of college, he sat me down and he did one of those dad things. And he said, son, I want to show you all the investments in case I get hit by a truck. You can take care of your mother and your brothers. And I'm like, okay. Oh, finally, I learned the secrets, right? And I start looking at all these stocks that he owns. And I look at this one and I go, oh, what is this? And he goes, oh, yeah, that went down 99%.
Oh.
And I'm like, I don't remember that story around the dinner table.
Yeah.
And what's this one? Oh, well, that went down 90%, but now it would cost more to sell it than it's worth. So I just hang on to it in case someday maybe it comes back up. And then I'd find stories where he bought a stock for 50 and it went down to 20. So he sold it. And then it went back up to 60 and he bought it. And then it went down to 10 and he sold it again. And I'm like, you lost.
He's doing the exact opposite. Yeah,
you lost more money than the stock was ever worth. How do you keep making these mistakes? And now he had some huge winners. Mm-hmm. And we talk about this in skeptics stuff. We remember the hits and we forget the misses. And he was doing the same thing as someone who goes to a psychic. And he genuinely thought he was beating the market. But I'm an analytical data person. So when I sit down and figure this out, he was underperforming the stock market by 4% a year, which is totally normal for humans to do. Most people underperform the market by about 4% a year. Check out the data and compare your results to the actual data and you'll be sad. But then you can fix it. So that started me down this path of like, okay, how does this work? And so I've always come at investing from an academic perspective, not a sales perspective. Mm-hmm. So what do I look forward to? I look forward to being able to go to Italy every single year. I'm not quite there yet, but hopefully soon I will be able to afford a nice Italian vacation. I can use my Italian. I can see pieces of civilization that are more than 1,000 years old. And enjoy the culture and the scenery and the Mediterranean and the beautiful weather.
Oh, what's your favorite part of Italy?
I don't know yet, because I haven't been to all of it. I'm going to try to see all of it. But one of my, I'll give you two. One of my places is the area of Sorrento.
Okay.
And that is a little bit south of Naples, Napoli, and the Amalfi Coast, mm-hmm. and the island of Capri. And this area is also known, it's famous for lemons.
Huh, weird.
So they make limoncello, they like make lemon meringue, they make lemon everything. And I love lemons, and I love this area, and I love the views. And the city of Sorrento is up on a cliff, and they actually carved a road into the cliff. And it's beautiful. So cool. And then they've got this little dock. Another place, totally different, is Bologna. Mm-hmm. Which I love particularly because we went there because it's not known for tourism. Mm-hmm. And when we would go there, only a small portion of the people spoke English, so I got to use more of my Italian. When we checked into our room in Bologna, the lady checking us in says, are you guys vegetarians? Mm-hmm. And my first response was, do I look like a vegetarian? I'm a doughy white guy. I don't fit the mold, but... why do you ask? And she says, when vegetarians come to Italy, or to Bologna, they are not very happy. And I said, why is that? And she says, in Bologna, a vegetarian meal is a salad with only a little ham in it.
That's hilarious.
And they have ham and beef in every meal. And here's one of the mind-blowing things I didn't know before I went there. In Bologna proper, they will not use garlic in their recipes.
That makes me happy. I don't really like garlic.
Well, you will love bologna because the philosophy, the ancient philosophy, because Bologna used to be a very, it still is a very important mercantile city. It's a place where you can go see real big city Italy without the tourism of like Rome. Mm. The idea of garlic was used to cover shitty meat.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Garlic is so freaking strong. I don't like it in my food because it's all I can taste.
And so the restaurants there do not use garlic. If you make garlic recipes in a restaurant there, you will go out of business because they assume that you're using shitty meat and now you're trying to cover it.
I appreciate, man. You know, I've only been to Venice, which I know is not really like main Italy. It's kind of its own strange world.
Well, the way my son described Venice is it's hot, smelly, and full of Americans. And I thought, I have that here.
It is. That's true. And it's wet. It's very wet.
Yeah.
Which is something that you have to get used to. Luckily, Venice was a leg of a beautiful trip that I took to Bavaria and to... where else did I go on that trip? I was in Munich and I also went to Vienna and it was quite lovely. And Venice was beautiful. It is a very beautiful city, but it is also like the epitome of a tourist trap in Italy. But I mean, it's definitely worth seeing. It's worth staying at, but it does smell really bad.
You know what is in that area that you traveled through that I want to take my daughter to so desperately?
What?
I want to take her to the genuine, original, as seen in the movie, Von Trapp family house.
Oh, yeah. I could see that.
Because she loves the sound of music. And who doesn't, right? but to go there and see where Julie Andrews sang, I think that would give me chills. And that's weird because I generally don't like musicals, but that one is delightful.
That's an odd choice for a favorite musical. I get it. People love it. People like to go to the sing-alongs. I probably wouldn't choose that one, but I get it. Who doesn't love, you know, music and Nazis?
Music and Nazis is
really,
good.
When it comes
and,
you know, down
but
to
then we see a lot of theatrical productions locally. We support the arts, and we recently went and saw, and I'd never seen it before. I had no idea what the plot was. Have you ever seen Seven Brides for Seven Brothers?
No, I haven't.
Oh my God! What bizarrely sicko, misogynistic play that is.
Oh, so not good?
Oh, I was squirming in my seat. I mean, it's clearly from a different time.
Yeah.
But the idea that these seven brothers just sweep into town and pick up some babes and kind of knock them on the head and drag them by their long hair back up into the mountains.
Oh my God.
And you're just kind of going, oh my God. And around that is 14 people in spontaneous synchronized dancing, which is what I cannot stand. It's like Oklahoma, 80 people just break into unified dance. No, that's not how it works. That's my issue with musicals. I'm sorry. I know people are going to be upset. You're probably going to get letters and emails about this, but I can't do it.
No, I think they'll get it. I don't really like musicals either.
No.
I'm really bad about not going to see the theater as often as I should. And I live in LA and we have a very good, you know, arts kind of culture here. My favorite musical that I've seen, of course, is The Book of Mormon, because how could it not be my favorite? Yeah.
We went and saw, what is it, the Chinese theater?
Mm-hmm.
And we were there and a couple of people in costumes came up to my wife and said, hey, would your kids like to pose with us for a picture? And she goes, okay.
Okay.
And she takes a couple of pictures and they said, there is a fee for us posing in your pictures.
Yeah.
And she goes, what? And I was like, we're not paying it. And they go, well, you have to. And I go, really? My wife goes, no, it's okay. What is it? And he says, it's $5. And she goes, oh, okay. Well, for each of us. Okay, per photo. And you took 5 photos.
Oh, LA.
And so she starts digging out this money and I go, no, you're not paying $50 for people that came up to you and asked you to take pictures. She goes, but that's what their fee is. And I go, no, we're not paying it. So buyer beware.
Always buyer beware. That's good advice. I think that's good advice to go out on. Well, Phil, before you go, let everybody know where they can find your podcast and where they can find you online.
If they haven't already figured it out, my company is Polaris Financial Planning. you can email me, phil@polarisfinancialplanning.com. You can follow me on Twitter, Skeptic Money. You can find me on Facebook, Phil Ferguson, although I'm almost out of list space for friends. And you can also follow the Phil Ferguson Show on Facebook. That is the first best place to get updates and information about the show. Of course, the podcast is hosted by Spreaker, but you can get it on Stitcher, iTunes, or, of course, put the feed directly into your favorite player. If you can't find it with a simple search, you let me know and I'll send it to you. But most people are going to be able to find it, but I'm there to help. And, of course, if you have that old pesky 401k that needs to be moved over and put to better work, especially after you watch that Frontline episode we talked about, let me know how I can help you, and we'll see if we can make it work smarter for you.
I love it. It's almost like you've said that before.
It's almost like I know how to shamelessly self-promote and whore myself. Yeah.
It's necessary. You know what? We've got here Phil, the fiduciary Ferguson.
That's right.
Evidence-based investor, science-based investor. Thank you so much for joining me on the show.
It has been my pleasure, and I'm so sorry we went over the 60-minute limit, but it seemed like good fun.
Yeah, no, it's a loose parameter there. It was a great time. I learned a lot. I know my listeners did too.
And of course, they can listen to you again from Tuesday's episode of the Phil Ferguson Show.
Yes, they can. Yes, tune in. Yep. Tuesday's episode. It's on my website, carasanamaria.com. Everybody, I'm looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.